So if you've never heard of John D. Loudermilk, have you ever heard of him? You've never heard of him, Casera? Well, you're going to listen to it today then. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. Right here at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, new episode is posted up at WGNplus.com. Episode 76. Underway. And don't forget, episode 75 through 1. Wow. Are on my landing page at WSplus.com. You just, or not WLS, WGNplus.com. And you just go into the entertainment section and hit the prompt for Captain Podtastic, and all 75 are up there for your binge-worthy pleasure. And I have decided at this point I am binge-worthy. So be a glutton and go to the landing page and listen to as many as you can. Don't you have extra 75 hours just hanging around doing nothing? Here's a way to fill it. Today on the podcast, I'm very pleased and excited to have a very special guest, a good friend of mine and one of the most respected, noted, and in-demand musicians in the business. I've known this guy for over 20 years, and I was recently talking to him, and he told me about even more albums that he was on that are in my collection that I didn't even know. John Jorgensen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jim. How you doing? You sound fantastic.
Oh, well, I sound podtastic.
Yes, you do. You do sound podcastic. I've never said that word before, believe me.
Well, it's a little difficult initially to roll off the tongue, but after a while, it becomes second nature, and obviously it's a hint to one of your former employers.
Well, it is. Captain Podtastic, yes.
Yes, exactly. And I hope that...
you can't get away from Elton on your show, right?
No, well, yeah, and I hope. Well, yeah, hopefully his lawyers don't look at the logo I created, because it basically uses the same...
Okay, let's not remind them. Yeah, let's move right along to other things.
Here we go. So John Jorgensen is one of the, as I said before, one of the noted session as well as musicians in the business. He has worked with some of the most legendary people, including Elton John, most recently Tom Petty. He's had a distinguished career of his own as part of the Desert Rose Band and the Helicasters. He's got several of his own bands that span several different music genres, and it's just it's not even hyperbole to say that that you really are a musical savant and musical renaissance man. And it's always fun to sit and talk to you, because you're doing so many different things. And as I said, I've known you for almost 20 years now, which is kind of scary.
I know, we were only 10 when we met. Isn't that funny?
And every time I talk to you, I still learn new things about what you've done or who you've worked with, and so it's always fun to go into the John Jorgensen mine and find out what's in there. So, what's interesting once again is some of your most recent and current projects, which once again fall right into if you're a music fan of any kind, there's always something interesting going on in John's career. I have to admit, we talked about this. Your latest project is a tribute to one of the most noted songwriters, especially in the 50s and 60s, John D. Loudermilk. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't know the name. I heard the name, wasn't initially aware of what it was, but give the people a quick rundown, because two or three of these songs are instant standards, and so many times the songwriter gets doesn't get the credit he deserves, but John D. Loudermilk certainly deserves the recognition, and that's what you're doing with this tribute album. So give the folks a little background on him.
Well, that's exactly right, Jim. John D. was just a prolific writer who had hits in genres from bluegrass to rockabilly to heavy metal to pop, country, jazz, instrumental, all over the map. That's one of the things that's so unusual about him. He's an old friend of my wife's, and she didn't feel like he'd gotten his due, you know, as much as he should, you know. So he's from Durham, North Carolina. His first hit as a songwriter was called A Rose and a Baby Ruth. It was recorded by George Hamilton IV, and it got both of their careers started. Shortly after that, that was in 1956, and in 1957, he wrote Eddie Cochran's first hit, Sitting in the Balcony, and then was asked by Chet Atkins to write for him. He wrote the instrumental Windy and Warm, which has become a signature song for Chet Atkins and more recently for Tommy Emmanuel, and pretty much for any guitar player that wants to learn how to finger pick, they have to learn that song. And this was, these were followed by hits for Stonewall Jackson, Waterloo, more George Hamilton, Abilene, then the Nashville Teens in the 60s with Tobacco Road.
I mean, Tobacco Road. That's a classic.
That was covered by David Lee Roth, Edgar Winter, Lou Rawls. And then he had songs like Break My Mind that was recorded by the Flying Burrito Brothers and Linda Ronstadt. Ebony Eyes, recorded by the Everly Brothers, had a song called Turn Me On, which was recorded first by Eartha Kitt in the 60s and then by Nora Jones on her most successful album. Songs like This Little Bird, which was recorded by Marianne Faithfull in the 60s and Jewel in the 90s. It one of his other biggest known songs is a kind of a lowrider / R&B hit by the Casinos in 1967 called Then You Can Tell Me Goodbye.
You know, I have a daily, on my Facebook page, I have a daily feature, which I go through my iPod, I have almost 24,000 songs on my iPod. And so I scroll through and I try to find songs that people either have forgotten about or maybe never even heard of, depending on your age, or just songs that have always been my favorites, and I give a little background on it. And what's so funny is about 4 or 5 months ago, I put Then You Can Tell Me Goodbye as one of those songs, but I did use the Eddie Arnold version.
Okay.
Because that was one of Eddie Arnold's big hits.
Sure.
And I never even, I never knew that the Casinos even did it, because I always remember hearing as a young kid, and then obviously, and really the first place I ever heard that song was probably, if you remember those TV albums they used to sell on television?
Oh, sure. Yeah, well, A-Tel Presents.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there was one in the late 70s where they were doing a greatest hits of Eddie Arnold, and they would always just show or play little snippets of the greatest hits. And I just remember hearing the, and then you can tell me goodbye. And I was like, wow, what a great song must be.
Oh, it's such a romantic, beautiful song. And just as we talk about that song, that's a testament to John D, because you know it as a country crooner from Eddie Arnold.
Right.
But most people know it as sort of a lowrider / R&B pop hit by the Casino.
Wow, yeah, that's...
That was followed up by Indian Reservation by Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Now, that's the song, and you talk about a songwriter and being able to, to span different kinds of subjects. Now, if people don't remember, because that title is kind of a misnomer, but that's the song from the late 60s, early 70s that went, Cherokee people, ba-ba-ba-ba-bum, Cherokee tribe, and so who would think that he would write that song? It sounds so different from Then You Can Tell Me Goodbye.
Well, that's his genius. He wrote Sad Movies, for Sue Thompson, Norman, Hold the Ladder Steady. I mean, so many great songs, and he was most active in the 50s and 60s, but then the songs are so timeless that they've been covered as recently as Jay-Z and Kanye West. So
what did those two do? What did those two cover?
I don't even know. I don't even know that.
But they have covered his music. Yeah, that's crazy.
Exactly. You know, from the Flying Burrito Brothers to Lou Rawls to Edgar Winter to David Lee Roth to Stonewall Jackson to George Hamilton. And in fact, like, not that many years ago, his song Blue Train was the bluegrass song of the year by Doyle Lawson in Quicksilver. And so, you know, to what we're talking about today, this is an album from a live show that my wife produced. I was a musical director, and we invited 27 different artists to come and sing each one of John Dee's songs. So Rodney Crowell came and sang Tobacco Road. Tommy Emmanuel played Windy and Warm. Doyle Lawson and Quicksilver did Blue Train. Roseanne Cash did Then You Can Tell Me Goodbye. Emmylou Harris did a song, a little-known song of his called Where Have They Gone. John McPhee from the Doobie Brothers, who I just was speaking to earlier today, he did a great version of Indian Reservation. Leroy Parnell did Mr. Jones. Ricky Skaggs did Waterloo. The Whites did Heaven Fell Last Night. So it was a fantastic evening, you know, and all of these artists were there to pay tribute, and John Dee was still alive at that time. It was about 6 months before his passing.
Oh, so he was able to experience this and feel the love and feel the recognition and the respect from all those distinguished artists as well as the audience then, huh?
He was, and it made, you can imagine all of those people singing and playing his songs for him. There was an extra amount of feeling and, you know, like, for example, Tommy Emmanuel plays Windy and Warm all the time. But that night, it was a very, very special performance because he said that song changed his life. And here he was getting to perform it for the guy who wrote it. So it was a lot of emotion. And that was captured kind of at the last minute. We had plans to film the show. And there was a long shot camera, and there was a medium shot camera, and there was going to be a close-up camera, right? But then the decision was made to put that close-up camera on John Dee himself so that we could see his reactions. And so the whole show, first of all, the album, 24 of those 27 songs were able to be fit on one CD, and that came out September 15th, and now it's in the running for a Grammy.
Really?
For Best Americana Album. I'm so excited.
Oh, wow. And we should say that
it's a very competitive field, but, you know, with all of those artists and the high quality of songs, you know, who knows?
And we should say that you are a Grammy winner.
I am a Grammy winner. I hope that I'm soon a multiple Grammy.
And what was the...
I'm one of the performers on the show, but more importantly, I mixed and edited all of the music into this album. And it wasn't even a plan, really, to do an album at first. It was just we were going to do a television special. So I started mixing the music for a TV special, and the music was coming out so good that I gave it to my manager. And, in fact, he only listened to through the second song that I gave him, and the second song was one called Everybody Knows. It's sung in a trio with Harry Stinson, Handsome Harry from Marty Stewart's band, Harry Stinson taking the lead, and Beth Hooker and myself in a trio vocal with him. And it's ironically one of John Dee's little-known songs from his time as an artist. He was billed as Johnny Dee in the 50s, and you know, the song's called Everybody Knows, but not that many people know this song.
And so
the manager heard the song, and he went, oh, my God, this is the one that has to open the album, and I'm going to get a deal. And that's exactly what he did.
So where was the performance? Where did it take place?
It took place at a beautiful theater in Franklin, Tennessee, called the Franklin Theater. It's a restored old movie theater, and they've restored it with state-of-the-art audio and video. So it's a very nice concert venue, and they also show films there. And surprisingly, this Tuesday, we are going to have a screening of the entire show there at the Franklin Theater.
Oh, nice. So where can people get the album?
Well, it's available on Amazon and iTunes. So they can download it or mm-hmm. physical product.
Right.
And I'll also have some with me on some shows coming up. I'm playing, for example, well, this is interesting. Monday night, I'm playing at the Troubadour here in Los Angeles, where, of course, you know where Elton John's career got started in the U.S.
And the Eagles and so many people. Yeah, the Troubadour in L.A. is one of the most historic and mythical venues, especially for...
Venerable venue. And more importantly for this particular show, it's the spot where the Byrds met each other.
Oh, really?
Roger McGuinn, Gene Clark, and David Crosby met each other, yes, at, you know, playing Hoot Nights at the Troubadour, open mic nights, as it were. So this will be a performance with Chris Hillman, who was one of the original Byrds, for an album that was produced by Tom Petty, who, you know, very sadly we recently lost. It was rescheduled from last week. It's this Monday. So we'll be playing, you know, this music that Tom helped to produce and get out there in the world. And that's Monday night. And as soon as we get off stage, I'm catching a red eye to fly to Nashville for the screening the next day. But more importantly, I'm on live radio at 8 a.m. with Bill Cody, who's one of the announcers for the Grand Ole Opry. And then midday, I'm doing a television show called Today in Nashville on Channel 4. And then a couple hours after that, doing an interview with Craig Havighurst, a noted journalist in Nashville, and then in the evening, having the screening of the film. So I get to sit back and watch the film and watch all the performances and listen to all my mixes and kind of experience what it was like for the audience that night in the theater. I'm so excited.
Yeah, well, like I said, you gave me a copy. John was just in the Chicago area recently, with Chris Hillman and Herb Peterson performing many songs from both their stint together as the Desert Rose Band from the 80s, country band in the 80s and early 90s, as well as Chris Hillman's new solo album, which John just said was produced by Tom Petty. And so you gave me a copy of the album. And like I said, I've been listening to this, and there are so many songs that, like you're saying, that either I was not aware of that I'm saying wow, or B, that I wasn't aware that I even knew, but did know just through the osmosis and the zeitgeist and listening to music of all different kinds. And so it was really kind of a fun discovery. And as I said, it's always for music fans, it's always fun, I think, to find new music, whether it is, you know, anything could be new music to you, whether it was just recorded 2 days ago or whether it was recorded 50 years ago. If you haven't heard it before, it's new to you. And,
exactly.
Yeah, and I think what's great about this is that there are so many talented musicians and songwriters that for whatever reason, you know, they either had, you know, a very quick moment in the spotlight, or they never really ascended to, you know, the heights that maybe their talent should have put them in. And so it's great when people like you who are not only talented musicians, but really are, you know, students and pupils of just music itself. And you have such a vast knowledge, as I said, of not only a musician that plays bluegrass and gypsy jazz and rock, and country, I mean, and guitar, you know, based, you know, music. I mean, you name it. And as I said, when you look at what John plays in terms of instruments, the mandolin, the mandocello, the dobro, the pedal steel, the piano, the upright bass, the clarinet, the bassoon, and the sax. I mean, what's left? I mean, there's also the kitchen sink and the spoons. I'm sure that
you. Well, thank you. Well, you know what's funny on this on that one show. I had to make myself a special set list to tell me what instrument to play next, because I played piano, organ, acoustic guitar, electric guitar, mandolin, sang harmony vocals, sang lead vocals, sang bass vocals. It was, and then I ended up, you know, also music directing, and then mixing and editing and mastering. So the project, it really took so many of my skill sets, and so...
Which is fun too, right?
So many different ways.
Pardon? Yeah. Which is fun for you.
Totally fun for me, because I've spent my whole life developing these skill sets, and to get to use them is really fun. And I'm wondering, are a lot of your listeners Elton fans?
Well, no, I mean, I don't really, I mean, the show, I just use that as a, I mean, you know, I mean, my nickname for the last several years has been Elton Jim on the radio.
Of course.
And so given to me by somebody that I used to work with. And so that just sort of stuck, and it's been fun to play with. And so when I was putting together the podcast, I just thought, you know, to strengthen that brand name, I would put that in the title. And then I just thought of the Captain Podtastic as a nice little subtle nod to him. If those that get the reference get it, if not, then I'm Captain Podtastic. And what does that mean? It means whatever
right,
it wants.
Captain.
So, yeah. So,
well, I'm gonna share you. I think I told you this story when we saw each other, but it kind of ties in three or four different things, which is kind of fun. So, indulge me here for a minute. And so, one of the songs on this John D. Loudermilk tribute album is called "Sad Movies," and Deborah Allen sings "Sad Movies" on this tribute album. She had a hit of her own in the 80s called "Baby, I Lied," country and pop. So this song, "Sad Movies," was actually a hit for Sue Thompson back in the early 60s and written by John D. Loudermilk, interestingly, from a female perspective of a girl whose boyfriend says he's working and can't go to the movie with her, so she goes by herself, and lo and behold, she sees him coming in with another girl, and they sit right in front of her and start making out. So she cries and goes home and tells her mom that she's crying, because sad movies always make her cry. So it's an amazingly written song from a female perspective, written by, you know, at that time, an older man. So, but the interesting thing about this song is that Sue Thompson was the artist, okay? Elton John had gotten popular in the early 70s, and Elton is like us. He knows everything about old songs and music and who played and wrote and sang. So Sue Thompson came to see Elton's show, and he knew who she was and invited her backstage to say hello, because he knew her records. Well, she came and brought her son, and she told Elton that her son was interested in becoming a record producer or an engineer. Well, Elton invited her son. Elton said, well, have him come and watch us make our next album. And so, of course, he took advantage of that invitation and got to go watch them record Goodbye, Yellow Brick Road.
In 1973.
One of Elton's very best artistic achievements. So, fast forward many years later, this gentleman named Greg Penny does become a producer, and he produces an album for Katie Lang, her most successful popular album called Ingenue. Elton loved this album, wanted to know who produced it, Greg Penny. Well, and invited Greg to produce his next album, which became Made in England. Again, to my ears, a return to perhaps Elton's top form of great classic English pop songwriting.
Oh, yeah, one of his best albums in the last 25 years, definitely.
And that album had a lot of guitar parts on it, more than Davy Johnston could do by himself on stage. So that's the album that Elton and Davy invited me to join up to promote that album and tour with him. So it all started out with John D. Loudermilk song called "Sad Movie."
Isn't that funny?
Unbelievable. Right?
And then that's how John and I met, because back in the mid '90s, I was writing for an Elton John fan magazine, and so then got to know him, and actually for a while there. So John, you were with Elton for a good 5 years on the road, traveled the
6 years actually.
6 years traveled the world. You know, you played on a few of his albums that he recorded during that time. You recorded with people like Pavarotti. I mean, you went all around the world. You played some of the classic and well-known venues in the world. I mean, that had to have been a crazy and exciting time as a musician. I don't know. Were you ever an Elton John fan, or did you become one?
Sure. I was a fan. You know, not like a crazy fan, but I remember well one of my actual bandmates at the time bringing over Goodbye Lyric Road when it was new.
And the cool thing,
we listened to it and went, wow, this is phenomenal.
And one of the
I always loved his more rocking songs because I was a young guitar player at that time. So the piano-based ballads were okay, but I really liked, you know, Saturday Night and Mitch's Back and even like Candle in the Wind, the songs that had more prominent guitar on it. And that's just because I was a young guitarist. You know, now I listen back and the quality of all the songs is so good.
Well, the cool thing is that while John played with Elton for 6 years, he had a custom guitar made. Do you still have it? Well, with the cover.
I certainly do.
With the cover of Goodbye Yellow Brick Road on the guitar, and it is just gorgeous.
Oh, it's so beautiful. It is airbrushed by a fantastic artist. And, you know, that guitar was one of many of my instruments that was underwater for a week or more during the huge flood in Nashville.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, no.
And surprisingly, you know, the valuable thing about that guitar, I mean, it is a limited edition guitar. It was a signature model built for me by Fender. And the model was built between 1998 and 2002. So not that many were built. And this particular one has that special artwork. So it's a one-of-a-kind guitar of a limited edition custom shop model. And the most unique thing, of course, is the paint job. And surprisingly, if you saw that guitar, you would not be able to tell anything ever happened to it.
Oh, well, that's good.
Underwater. That's... Not just water, but
liquid,
diesel fuel, and for a week. And amazingly, it lasted through, and it still looks great to this day. And I in fact, there's another connection, sorry, but that's the guitar that I play on the show and on the album.
Oh.
Jimmy Loudermilk.
Oh, very cool.
I do a song called Midnight Bus, and it's probably the most rocky of all the performances. And another Elton connection, Charlie Morgan, who played drums with Elton most of the time I was with him, and for 13 years, I think, overall, he plays drums on the whole
show
and album.
Nice.
So here you got Charlie and me and my Goodbye Yellow Brick Road Telecaster doing a song called Midnight Bus. And Midnight Bus was written in the 60s about a bus from Durham, North Carolina. It would go to South Carolina, and the legal age for getting married was lower in South Carolina.
Yeah, tell so Jerry Lee Lewis that.
Kids would take this bus from Durham, you know, to South Carolina to get married.
Yeah.
And again, in this little story, which takes place in like a 2.5-minute song, you know, they're going on the bus to get married, and then they have an argument, and the guy pulls the buzzer cord and makes the bus stop and gets off, and he's standing there. At the end of the song, he's standing by the side of the road with his little suitcase, you know, watching his girlfriend and his future and everything just kind of go out of sight.
So if you can, so once again, so let's talk about that. So it is called A Tribute to John D. Loudermilk, and you can get that on Amazon or iTunes or other areas. Is there even a website for that?
There is a Facebook page and a website. And I'm sure if you type it into Google, it'll be easier to find.
I think on the back here, I see it's actually a tribute to John D. Loudermilk, L-O-W-D-E-R.
No, not L-O, like loud.
Oh, I'm no, sorry, L-O-U-D-E-R-M-I-L-K.com. So that's someplace you can go for that. Now, if you can, you know, since it's so timely and you just were mentioning it earlier, you did have the opportunity, ironically and sadly, this year, calendar year 2017, when you worked on Chris Hillman's solo album, and you were in a band with Chris Hillman, one of the original members of the Byrds in the 80s and early 90s, the Desert Rose Band, and had several major country hits. You worked on his solo album this year, and Tom Petty, as you said, who was a huge Byrds fan, produced it. Can you give, were there any interesting stories or just kind of any reactions or feelings you have? I saw a great picture that was up on Facebook of you with Tom Petty in his guitar-filled studio as you were recording, but just several months ago, but now given his shocking passing, can you share anything of what it was like to, had you met him before, or what was it like to work with him? How did he feel about you as a musician? Any kind of things you can share that you feel comfortable about?
Sure. Well, I was a fan of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers the very first time I ever heard Listen to Her Heart.
Oh, no kidding.
Because it sounded like the Byrds.
Yeah.
And at that time, too, the music had gone a lot more keyboard-oriented, a lot of disco and sort of jazzy stuff like that. And no offense to any of that, I like that too, but again, you know, I got into this because I love playing guitar, and I love playing rock guitar, so when I heard that guitar-based sound of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, I just went, yes, this is cool. And then, you know, their songs kept coming on really good, like Breakdown and Refugee and Don't Do Me Like That, and Don't Come Around Here.
Well, like I said, if you don't...
Back Down, and on and on and on.
I've said, if you don't have Damn the Torpedoes in your record collection, then you don't have a record collection.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. So, and then, you know, I ended up meeting Tom a number of times. I worked a lot with Howie Epstein, who was his bass player. Howie was producing John Prine and Carlene Carter. In fact, won a Grammy for John Prine's album that he produced, and I played a lot on those. Got to be very close with Howie, and you know, sadly, he passed away. But I also wrote with Stan Lynch, and Stan played with me in a band backing up Roger McGuinn on his album Back from Rio.
And Stan was the drummer for the Heartbreakers for many years.
Yeah, and we played on at the Troubadour. We played a show, and Tom came and sat in on that show. There's actually a clip on YouTube you can see. If you type in my name and Tom Petty and Roger McGuinn, you'll see it.
Yeah, I've seen that. It's very cool.
So, you know, and I played many times with Ben Montench, the keyboard player. And so I was very, you know, I was kind of in the world with him, and he was always such a nice guy, really approachable, and never acted like a big star. So to record with him last January, it was in his, he calls it his clubhouse, and it was full of every kind of cool guitar you could ever imagine. I had to not look at stuff so that I would concentrate on what I was doing. And he was just a great producer, you know. He was very unintrusive and would make us come and listen and just give very, very light and easy guidelines, you know, because he realized that we all knew what we were doing, but he could listen from an objective standpoint, not being one of the performers. And really, it was one of the most pleasant experiences. And certainly, you know, he was a big Beatles fan, too, so we would just get off and talking about Beatle trivia and about their guitars and the way they recorded and minutia and stuff. And, you know, the other guys would have to kind of go, okay, you guys need to shut up now so that we can actually record.
Well, that was the one thing about Tom Petty that from my standpoint of just purely, you know, an admirer and a fan of his, as you said, dating back to, you know, American Girl and Breakdown and Listen to Her Heart. And then obviously when Damn the Torpedoes hit in 1979, that was the one that just tipped everybody, you know, over the line. But the thing that I really liked about him being a music fan is that he really, to your point, what you just said, it really did feel, at least, it, you know, from having seen him perform several times and just listening to his music and hearing the different influences, it was pretty clear that, you know, he was really a true fan of music. It wasn't just that he was, you know, a performer or a songwriter and he had his own style, but you could just tell by the songs that he chose to cover and the people that he associated with. He was lucky enough to have worked with many of his idols, like the Byrds, like Bob Dylan. He loved the Beatles, and there he was in the Traveling Wilburys with George Harrison.
Okay, so here's a little story you'll like. You know, when we were working on Chris's album, I tried to stay focused on what we were doing and not be a fan, you know, not bother Tom with fan questions.
Right.
I could do that, you know. I could do that for quite a while. But at one point, I think he mentioned something about the Traveling Wilburys, you know.
Uh-huh.
And one of my favorite moments on record is in Handle Me With Care, when George Harrison comes in with his slide guitar.
Yeah.
So beautiful. It's so simple, but it's so distinctive. And it's so George, you know?
Yeah, you could tell it's him, definitely.
Exactly. So I said to Tom, you know, I'm just wondering, you know, that part when George Harrison put on his slide part for Handle Me With Care, you know, were you there in the studio for that? And Tom lowered his head and looked at me and he said, I was there for everything. And just the way he said it told me that, remember, dude, I'm also a fan.
Right.
I can watch George Harrison do a slide part. I'm going to be there watching it. If I can watch Bob Dylan do a vocal,
right,
I'm going to be there. So
yeah.
I asked him, well, it's such a beautiful part. What is it? What is it about George's playing that, you know, makes it sound like that? And he said, it's just him, man. There's somebody else set up the guitar, somebody else set up the amp. You know, they tried it and got the mic going. And then once it was in George's hands, it just sounded like that.
That's funny. You know? Well, and my question to you is, being such an admirer of his, as well as having a lot of the same musical heroes, sharing that between you, when you are brought into this session, and I said you've worked with some amazing people. You just mentioned John Prine. When we met recently, I didn't even know that you were on one of my favorite albums of all time, which is Bonnie Raitt's, Grammy award winning album. I'm blanking.
Nick of Time.
Nick of Time, which is a great song. But you play this beautiful guitar opening, and throughout the song, this beautiful solo that starts the song on the song called "Too Soon to Tell," which I've always loved, and I hum. I just hum it, just as I'm driving in the car, and little do I know that it was your guitar on that. You're talking about George Harrison's, little slide thing on Handle Me With Care, but that was the thing that just jumped out at me when I first heard it back in 1987, and little do I know that that it was your piece. And so my point is, when you are dealing with some of these legendary people, like a Tom Petty, where do you draw the line between coming up to them and being a professional, because that's why you're there, for your own talent and to do a job, but then also the fanboy in you to want to pick their brains? Is there a fine line, or do you have to sort of juggle that, or what do you do?
Well, like in that instant, I waited till someone else had brought up. I think Tom might have even brought up the Traveling Wilburys. I'm not sure who did, but I didn't bring it up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's a timing thing, you know.
Right.
It was just the right timing, and we were like maybe going back out to play after listening to something, and I just had a moment, you know. But I think you know, the thing that you have to do is you're there, or I say I'm there for a reason. You know, for Bonnie Raitt, I'm there to play something differently than she would play it. You know, otherwise she would just do it herself, right?
Right.
And I know that everyone's time is really valuable. So there's really not time then to start asking fan questions, because that's really inappropriate.
Yeah.
And when you're working and trying to get something done. So, you know, if they start it, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like you said, Tom was such a big Beatle fan, so he showed me this book, you know, about the Beatles recording sessions and all the details about it. So I followed his lead, you know.
Right.
Jump in there with him.
Right.
But that's allowing him to be a fan of someone else. You know, mm-hmm. It's not me asking him questions about himself.
Yeah.
So, because that makes a lot of people uncomfortable, too.
Right.
You know, I did a project with David Lee Roth. And he was a very interesting guy, very funny. But he was, for the most of the time, he was in his stage character, even off stage.
Oh, really?
And I didn't have a chance. I was curious. He made a statement that his family was medical and military, and that's why he wanted to get an EMT license at one point. But I know that he really has a deep understanding and a natural flair for show business. You know, whether you like his shtick or not, it's very, very traditional show business. And so finally, we had done three or four things together, and we were having a meal, you know, at a El Coyote, which is a venerable Mexican restaurant on Beverly Boulevard in Los Angeles. And we finally had time, and I could ask him. He got a little bit out of character, you know, and just more to his natural personality.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to ask him, you know, like, if your family was all military and medical, how did you develop such an innate show business, you know, in yourself? And he said, oh, it was my uncle. He ran the Cafe Hua in Greenwich Village in the 60s, and I used to go spend my summers with him when I was growing up. So David Lee Roth got to watch his uncle settle up with Bob Dylan and Peter, Paul, and Mary and Bill Cosby and all of these different people, and talk to them about their acts and how they could get more people in the door and stuff like that. So that's how he got his show business sense, from spending time around his uncle.
Wow, who would have thought? I never heard that story. I always heard that his father was a doctor or something.
His father was, but
yeah.
His uncle, you know.
Yeah, who would? I never heard that story. That's wild. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the one thing I also have to say, in getting to know John and seeing him perform throughout the years, I credit you in many ways for helping to expand my musical knowledge as well as my musical awareness. I had heard the name just sparingly, but never really knew about the music or the person. And you really opened my eyes to somebody that now whose name has become much more well known as more musicians, and especially young people too, seem to be discovering Django Reinhardt, who is known for developing and being the master of what's called gypsy jazz. And if you ever hear that very intricate and swing kind of guitar playing from the 20s and 30s, it's Django. And I remember actually first hearing that music from the Woody Allen movie, The Sweet Lowdown.
Oh, yeah.
With Sean Penn and running, or maybe it was called The Sweet and Lowdown, but I remember running out and buying the soundtrack without knowing anything about what that, you know, what it was based on or who Django Reinhardt was. And then when I got to know you, you sort of introduced me to that music. And little do I know, over the last 20 years, you have actually become one of the most heralded and respected Django Reinhardt gypsy jazz performers in the world. And you have traveled the world playing gypsy jazz and Reinhardt music, as well as Reinhardt influenced music, to gypsy jazz fans all around the world. That's got to be quite satisfying for you.
Well, it's pretty amazing, yeah. And I Yeah, I'm called the American ambassador to Gypsy Jazz.
Oh, is that all?
It's something I take pretty seriously. I do love that music. And when I first discovered it in the late 70s, there was no kind of, there was no circuit. There was no interest. It was very, very underground. And I realized at that time, I really couldn't have a career playing that music. It was just too underground, and I couldn't find anywhere to play. No one was interested. So it just became my hobby music for the next 20 years. And then things changed in the world, and people seemed to discover it. And I think it's because of the internet what allowed people with, you know, kind of niche interests to find each other. And if enough found each other, they could start having festivals and bands. And so since 2003, I was asked to portray Django Reinhardt in a movie called Head in the Clouds, with Charlize Theron and Penelope Cruz. And I released another album in that style, and it kind of propelled me to now. I've played that. That's been my main focus for ever since then. So I'm thrilled that I could, you know, perform at the Montreal Jazz Festival, and I'm the only American to ever headline as a Gypsy Jazz guitarist at the Django Reinhardt Memorial Festival in France. So it's been a fantastic thing, and it's really helped all my musicianship. It's such a challenging type of music to play. And, you know, the thing that people don't realize is that Django influenced guitar playing, period, as we know it. Because George Benson, for example, was a huge fan of Django. And then everyone else, you know, was influenced by George Benson's jazz playing. And Chet Atkins was a huge fan of Django. So everyone that Chet Atkins influenced in country, you know, kind of can go back to Django. In bluegrass, Clarence White and Doc Watson were also fans of Django. In rock, Mark Knopfler, The Beatles, and Eric Clapton, and Peter Frampton. As a virtuoso guitarist, he's done so much for music in general and guitar playing as a lead solo instrument. It all goes back to Django, and he only had two functional fingers on his left hand.
Which is amazing. I mean, yeah, when you tell people, not only when you play that music for him, for people, you then say, you know, this guy didn't even have all his fingers.
Yeah, unbelievable.
It's crazy.
His hand was burned in a fire, and so his ring finger and his little finger were basically stuck and useless, you know?
Wow, but when you hear that kind of guitar that goes, and it's just and then, of course, he had the hot tub with Stefan Grappelli, which then is still just, you know, classic stuff.
Oh, their music, yeah. The Quintet of the Hot Club of France. Stefan Grappelli was a great foil for Django. He played the violin in a swing jazz way that no one had done before. So here you have an acoustic guitarist and a violinist who at that time were not even considered, those weren't considered jazz instruments at all.
Right.
And they had a rhythm section of two rhythm guitarists and a bass. So to have a string quintet, basically, playing jazz music was very unusual. At that time, it was more like Louis Armstrong, trumpets and clarinet, like Benny Goodman,
right,
trombone, saxophone, drums and things. So they created this very swinging music that was actually more refined and could be at a higher class party, an event, because it had a refined, almost classical quality to it, but it swung like mad. And so Americans that heard it, you know, like all the people in Bob Wills, Western Swing, and, you know, later on, people like David Grisman kind of took inspiration from that and made a hybrid with bluegrass music and created a whole other style that at that time was either called new acoustic music or something like that. So it's been very influential in so many different styles.
And so I should say that, that as I said at the top of the podcast here, John is not only in demand with several leading musicians around the world to offer his talents and his multi-instrumental talents, but he also heads up, as I said, several different bands playing several different music. So, for instance, there is the John Jorgensen Quintet, which plays the gypsy jazz influenced music of Django Reinhardt, but then you also have the John Jorgensen Bluegrass Band, and you've played with Earl Scruggs, who is the ultimate country bluegrass banjo player. And now, isn't that where you won your Grammy?
No, I was nominated for a Grammy with Earl Scruggs.
Oh, okay.
That was the last album that he did, and I got to play on that with him. That was quite an honor. That was nominated.
Right.
But what I actually won the Grammy for was a country instrumental track with Brad Paisley.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for Best Country Instrumental. And funnily enough, those two awards were right next to each other in the ceremony.
Oh, wow. So you were like...
Yeah, I won the first one, and I was the only one there at the ceremony from that project, so I got to accept the award.
Oh, that's cool.
And then the next one following was the Best Bluegrass Album, and I was hoping, I had my fingers crossed, and Ricky Skaggs won that one.
Wow, you would have been like Sheryl Crow or Bonnie Raitt. You would have had like two in your arms.
Multiple Grammys. I was thrilled, and another Elton connection is that I took Bob Halley, who was Elton John's longtime personal assistant and manager. I took him with me to the ceremony, and we had a great time. And the funny thing is, he wasn't supposed to be working. He was just supposed to be my guest. But then after I won, there's a whole big publicity interview thing that you have to do. And so he became... instantly my personal assistant. So I had like the best personal assistant in the world, and he was there at the right time.
How funny. And then, of course, there's the John Jorgensen Electric Band. So, I mean, there's country, there's gypsy jazz, there's rock. I mean, as I said, you run the gamut. I'll tell you, I just went to see Elton recently, show number 170.
Fantastic.
And I must say, as good as the current band is, and they're certainly hitting a stride, and they've played together for many years, and he always gets the best. Elton's able to certainly play with the best musicians around, and he has a great appreciation for great musicians. But I still will say that when you were in the band, your versatility and your ability to play so many different instruments, because so many of Elton's songs have so many different instruments. There was nothing like it when you were playing live the saxophone solo, for instance, on The Bitch's Back, or the saxophone solo on Honky Cat, or the different horns on Can You Feel the Love Tonight, and different things that you brought to the table, your pedal steel on so many of his country flavored songs. And so I must say, as good as the current band is, I still wish that you were with them, because your talent and all those different instruments that you play certainly added a real feel and really elevated the sound and the music and the moment. And so you are certainly missed, I believe, even though it's a top-notch band.
I thank you very much, Jim. I mean, at the time, I think... After I left, a lot of people said, "Oh, that was Elton's best band. I wish you were back in it," and stuff like that. And, you know, I take those things with a grain of salt, and I think, okay, they're just being nice or whatever, right? And I don't look back that often, and I don't pat myself on the back very often either. I try to do my best all the time. But recently, someone posted on Facebook a video of... from a Rio concert from back in 1995, I believe it was, or maybe a little later. And it was Elton John performing in Rio to a huge audience. It was like 200,000 people or something. Amazing. But we were playing Rocket Man, and I remember, of course, I was in the band, and Guy Babylon was also in the band. It was a great... Ray Cooper, I think, was there too. It was a great, great setup of people. And the jam on Rocket Man was quite long. I forgot how long it was. But it was a group jam. And just within that song itself, I started, Davey and I both started on acoustic instruments. He was on a guitar, I was on a mandocello, and singing harmonies. And then as the jam went on, we had some little acoustic parts that we would do, and then it would go back to the piano, and then the keyboards would come in, and then at some point, Davey switches to slide guitar, and I switch to saxophone, and we jam more, and I was literally floored by this performance of this song. It sounded so amazing. Clive Franks did such a beautiful job of the mixing that I reposted it, and I hardly ever do that either. And I thought, you know what? People used to say this was a killer band of Elton, and I must say that I agreed. It was great. And that kind of ensemble jamming is really rare. I mean, it's more happens in jam bands than you would think in a, you know, pop song oriented artist like Elton. But that band could really jam together and do a dynamic thing that was interesting, held the audience interest, and was not self-indulgent. And he wasn't afraid to pass it around a little bit and let other people play some. Yeah. It's very cool.
Well, they do that now actually with Levon. And they have a very extended jam that's similar to that, where it goes off. It's a very long jam, and there's different solos for different people, especially Davey. And it goes places that you'd never expect a song like Levon.
I'll bet you there's no mandocello.
No, there isn't. No
saxophone.
No, there isn't. Well, I want to thank John Jorgensen for taking time of his busy schedule to talk and come on the podcast here. His latest project is one that is certainly worth your attention if you're a music fan. It's called A Tribute to John D. Loudermilk. It is 24 songs of a live performance showcasing the music by this, I guess I would say, not only talented, but to some extent, sadly, underappreciated songwriter, but whose songs you may have heard, like, and as we talked earlier in the podcast, well-known songs and major hits like Indian Reservation by Paul Revere and the Raiders, or Then You Can Tell Me Goodbye by Eddie Arnold, or The Casino, and Tobacco Road, which is just a classic song unto itself. So John put that together. He appears on it. He was a musical director for this. He produced it, and it's a project that is very near and dear to his heart. And it is available at Amazon and iTunes, and also at attributetojohndloudermilk.com. John Jorgensen, it is always fun to talk to you and get your insights and your little stories about an amazing career that has been at least, 35, 40 years and still going strong.
Yeah, and I was like I said, 10 when we met. So, Elton, Jim, I really appreciate it. I always enjoy talking with you. We could talk for hours. There's so many things that we're both interested in. Thank you. This has been podtastic.
There you go. See? Hey. Good branding. You, if anything else, you are a very good marketer, my friend.
Thank you, buddy.
Thank you, John.
I hope to see you soon.
Yeah, we hopefully, and once again, have fun out on the road there.
Will do.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
John Jorgensen joining us here at the podcast. You got that little outro music there? There it is. So that is episode 76 of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic here at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, a new episode is up and posted for your listening pleasure. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. This podcast is from the end of the web to your screen.